The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming and supporting Tom and this great institution, the Free Library. My name is Vernon Loeb. I'm a deputy managing editor at The Inquirer. Throughout the presidential debates last fall, I became very frustrated when I would hear John McCain repeatedly talk about the surge and what a big success it was. And the reason I was frustrated was that I had had the chance to read an advance copy of The Gamble. And I knew that the surge was quite a bit more complicated than John McCain would like to have it. And I think we'll hear a lot more about that tonight. I was lucky enough to spend 3 years covering the Pentagon with Tom at the Washington Post. And when I say lucky, I mean I was lucky because it's rare that you get to work with someone as talented as Tom and as generous with their talent as Tom. He's, you know, been covering the one of the reasons he's so good is he's been covering the military for better than a decade, and he's got an incredible Rolodex of military sources. There's nobody with a deeper reservoir of sources than Tom. To me, there are two things that really define Tom's military reporting and really set him apart, I think, from everyone else covering the military in Washington. The first is that he exhibits an almost anthropological fascination with all things military. You know, from the uniforms they wear to the weapons they use to the strategy, the tactics, the people. He just can't get enough. He's endlessly curious about the military. But his second great strength is he's not of the military. He remains a very independent and detached observer. And I think you'll see that independence on every page of The Gamble as you read it. So without further ado, let me introduce the most original thinker on the U.S. military in the country, Tom Ricks.
Thanks very much, Vern, for that kind introduction. Vern and I really enjoyed covering the Pentagon together at the Washington Post. You are lucky to have him here in Philadelphia. For my money, he is the best single reporter I know. My name is Tom Ricks. I'm going to take questions as soon as I can. I'm going to talk for about 20 minutes, then take questions for about 20 minutes, and then sign books for about 20 minutes. If there aren't that many books to sign. But I want to begin by asking a question. Do we have any veterans here tonight of Iraq or Afghanistan? Of Iraq or Afghanistan, yes. Thank you very much for your service. It is appreciated. And then I do particularly want to thank Vern Loeb again, not for the introduction, but for his role in this book, which was crucial. Besides being a great reporter, Vern is a great editor. And he read this book chapter by chapter, and at the end of each chapter would write me a memo. Here's what works, here's what didn't work. Get rid of the first two pages of this chapter. They're boring. It's exactly what you want from an editor, which is really enthusiastic, but very serious and careful reading of your book. If you ever get a chance to write for Vern, or if you want to write a book and have a great editor, Vern's your man. I want to talk first about some misunderstandings about the Iraq War. I think there are two major misunderstandings that I want to try to correct with this book, and I'm going to begin by talking about tonight. The first major misunderstanding is that the war is over. The war is far from over. I think we're really stuck in Iraq. I don't say that with pleasure, but I think it's just looking at the reality of the situation. General Odierno says near the end of my book that he would like to see 35,000 U.S. troops in Iraq in the year 2015. That would be well into what would be Barack Obama's second term in office. Ambassador Crocker, who reveals in the book that he himself was essentially opposed to the invasion of Iraq, says in the very end of my book that the events for which the Iraq War will be remembered have not yet happened. We may only be midway through this thing, halfway through this thing. Barack Obama's war in Iraq may prove to be longer than George Bush's war in Iraq, which was 5 years and 10 months. The second big misunderstanding is how difficult the surge was. The surge, to my mind, was the 6 toughest months of the war in Iraq, from January through June of 2007. And for some reason, the media wasn't able to pick up on it. People back here were kind of tuned out on the war anyways. I don't think it was really understood. It was very hard. It wasn't just adding a few thousand troops and suddenly everything changed. It was a 6-month battle to retake Baghdad and provide security to the people. And so that leads me to the last misunderstanding I want to begin by mentioning, where the surge came from. I don't believe the surge came from the White House, and I know it didn't originate with General Petraeus, who's widely credited with it. I think it came from General Raymond Odierno, largely. And this was a shock to me because in my previous book, Fiasco, I beat the hell out of General Odierno. I used him as an example of what was wrong with American generalship. I argued that he was counterproductive in his tactics, rounding up tens of thousands of military-age males, shipping them off to detention centers like Abu Ghraib. When I was talking to General Odierno about this, I said, this is in November, I said, my sense is that you were the natural father of the surge and Petraeus was the adoptive father. And he said, yeah, that's about right. But the surge began with yet another figure, General Jack Keane, a retired officer who, in the middle of 2006, went into opposition against the way the war was being executed. General Keane had actually been against the war itself at the outset. While still at the Pentagon on active duty, he had recommended against invading Iraq and had said, no, don't take your eye off the ball. Stay focused on Afghanistan and Pakistan. But in the summer of 2006, he was long retired. He was sitting in his basement one night in Fairfax, Virginia, and he was watching a rerun on C-SPAN of a hearing earlier that day. And he watched General Abizaid testify and General Casey, and he decided, this war is going down in flames. I need to do something about it. His wife found him sitting alone in his living room the next day as the room darkened as the sun set. She said to him, what are you thinking about? He said, the Iraq War. What are you thinking about that? She said, how to change it. And the irony was, this retired guy sitting in his house in Fairfax, Virginia, was able to. He went to Donald Rumsfeld, essentially got kicked out of his office. He went to other people. He finally wound up at the White House and said, your war is going wrong, and you got the wrong people and the wrong strategy. The White House really began to listen after the midterm elections of 2006. I don't think you would have had any of this change in Iraq without the midterm elections. They were the two before over the head that George W. Bush seemed to need. You're losing the war. You're losing the American people, and they're not buying what you're selling. Oddly enough, I think the 8 to 10 weeks that followed were George Bush's finest moment as president. And this was not something that came naturally to me to say. After the midterm elections, George Bush finally got serious about the war. He stopped being the cheerleader-in-chief for the war, which is what he'd been for several years, and he started being the commander-in-chief. What do I mean by that? Well, he started doing things like asking tough questions of his generals, started probing the differences between them. The Bush administration had tended to punish dissent and reward loyalty. Well, honest dissent expressed clearly inside channels is the highest form of loyalty. The Bush administration didn't seem to get that. Finally, it started listening to the dissenters, asking, what was their objection? Why wasn't this working? And what Bush heard back was, you need to hold your generals accountable. When they tell you something's going to happen and it doesn't happen, ask them why. So finally, Bush actually steps up to the plate and starts making some decisions. His January 10th, 2007 speech unveiling the surge, I, to my surprise, compare in this book to one of FDR's fireside speeches given in February 1942. In both of them, the president says to the American people, this isn't working, we're getting our butts kicked, but we want to come back, and eventually we think we will. This is how we think we're going to do it. The difference, of course, was that FDR did this 3 months into World War II, and it took George Bush more than 4 years to get to that point. by the time Bush started having an effective approach to the Iraq War, our equivalent time period of participation in World War II was over. So, in January 2007, effectively in Iraq, the transition to Obama began. In January 2007, the war was turned over to the dissidents, to the internal critics of the war. As I mentioned, Ambassador Crocker, our top diplomat out there, appointed at that time, had actually internally at the State Department been opposed to the invasion. General Petraeus had just finished this counterinsurgency manual, terrifically critical of the way the war had been fought. They brought in around them a really unusual group of people. The Americans were finally ready to listen. They were ready to show a little humility. Three of the top advisors brought in at that time were foreigners. David Kilcullen, an Australian infantryman turned anthropologist. Saadi Othman, a Palestinian-American born in Brazil, who on 9/11 had been a taxi driver in New York and decided that he had to somehow get involved. He had become at first General Petraeus' interpreter early in the war and then was brought back for this tour of duty as General Petraeus' ambassador to the Iraqi government. And what's intriguing about this is, well, two things. First, Saadi Othman is 6'7" tall, very tall for a Palestinian, the first person ever to dunk a basketball in Jordanian university competition. He also went on to be educated by Mennonites in America and was more or less a pacifist. So we have this Palestinian-American pacifist as an advisor to Petraeus. But even more astonishing to me was Emma Skye, who was brought in as Odierno's political advisor. Emma is a tiny, bird-like British woman, anti-American, anti-military, and a pacifist, fluent in Arabic and Hebrew. When she was offered the job of being General Odierno's political advisor, by coincidence, she had spent the weekend reading my book, Fiasco. And she listened to the offer over the phone from General Odierno and said, "I'll take the job on one condition. The first time I see you commit or condone a war crime, I'm personally reporting you to the War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague." Odierno, to his credit, said, "Okay." What she didn't know at the time is the United States military and government do not subscribe to the War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague. But nonetheless, her point stands. If she saw something happen, she was going to blow the whistle publicly. She wasn't going to tolerate it. These three people were influential in how the Americans thought, but also reflect the changed American approach. One of my favorite parts of the book is the story of Sam Cooke, a young captain in the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment. Oddly enough, the son of a religion professor in Northern Ireland, somehow wound up in the U.S. Army. Sam met up with a local insurgent in his little area of operations. Excuse me one second, I can blow my nose. Sam heard about this insurgent who had planted 200 bombs against the Americans after being radicalized by the Abu Ghraib detainee abuse scandal. Now, a few years ago, an American captain hearing of a local al-Qaeda operative would have either killed or captured him. Okay, identified him, took care of him, problem disposed of. This is the difference about the way the war was executed the last couple of years. What did Sam do? He invited the guy over for tea. The insurgent walks in rather suspicious and says, "Why aren't you killing me? Why am I going to be arrested as I sit down here?" And Sam said, "No, under the rules of hospitality, you are my guest. I've invited you. Now, if I see you on the street, I might shoot you. But here you are my guest. Let's talk." And they begin to talk. And they meet about once a week for weeks. And the insurgent explains where he came from and how Abu Ghraib radicalized him. And he says to Sam one day, "America is the devil. America makes everything bad, nothing good can come of America." Well, Sam had been around the block a couple of times in Iraq. And he said, "What about the movie Titanic?" He knew that Iraqis love Titanic. It's the most common ringtone on cell phones. And the insurgent pauses and says, "Yes, I have watched it 7 times. I cry at the end each time. When Leonardo DiCaprio slips into the water and Kate lets him go." And this was the beginning of a meeting of minds. They continue to meet for several more weeks, during which Sam finds out that the insurgent is trying to circulate a photo of Sam in order to have him killed if necessary. Meanwhile, Sam has his bodyguard come in, and there are also snipers, to study this insurgent's face while he's meeting with them, just to make sure that if he needs to kill him, everybody knows what he looks like. After several weeks more of this, the insurgent actually brings in himself and his network. And he comes to a reconciliation ceremony and says, okay, I'm going to start working with you. Put me on the payroll. As Sam put it, we had this economic power that America had never really used. Al-Qaeda was paying a lot of these guys. Sam puts them on the payroll. And the guy says, let's talk. Let me tell you how things work around here. And this conversation happened again and again in various forms in Iraq over the last couple of years. Let me tell you why you never caught me. When you came to our part of town, the Iraqi police at the checkpoints would call me. And when you came to my house, remember that cow that was always in the backyard? I had a trap door, and I'd hide underneath it, and the cow would sit on top of the trap door. And you Americans were too nice to the cow. You wouldn't move it. And you know that sniper rifle we have? Well, it was an Iraqi army major who gave it to us. And by the way, we have a deal with the local police chief. We don't fight him. He doesn't fight us. We fight the Americans. He stays out of it. Sam said it was like a light being turned on for him. Suddenly he could see this. And this light was turned on again and again in Iraq over the last couple of years. But for all that, what did the surge get us? The surge is now over. And it succeeded in improving security. But that was not its purpose. The purpose of the surge was a larger purpose. As the President and the Secretary of Defense put it, the purpose of the surge was to create a breathing space in which political breakthroughs could occur. Judged on its own terms, the surge failed. None, not one of the basic questions facing Iraq before the surge was answered during the surge or in its immediate aftermath. These are, for example, how do you share oil in Iraq between the major groups? What is the relationship between the major groups, the Sunnis, the Sunnis, the Kurds, and the Shiites? For that matter, what is the shape of the government, a strong central government or a loose confederation, a democracy or a military dictatorship? And what's the status of Kirkuk, the disputed city, you know, up in the northeast? And what's the role of Iran, which by and large is the largest winner in this war so far? Much increase in power and influence inside Iraq, including with many of the people that we think of as our supposed allies. None of these questions have been solved. All of them may yet be solved violently. So in that sense, the surge failed. It simply kicked the can down the road. But that may be about the best you can do in Iraq. The best case scenario may be kicking the can down the road and again and again. People say, well, what about the recent elections? Well, let me tell you, elections in Iraq are not like elections here. Elections here tend to be the end of contention and the beginning of normal processes. In Iraq, frequently, they are the beginning of contention. Remember those purple finger elections of a couple of years ago? What followed a few months later? A small civil war. In the past, elections in Iraq have tended to intensify sectarian differences, to delineate winners and losers. We don't know where the provincial elections that they've just held last month will go, but there's a chance they'll wind up like that. And guess what? There's two more rounds of elections in Iraq this year. The third round is a general national election at the end of the year, just as American troop numbers are supposed to be coming down. So I'm not real optimistic in the long run about Iraq, but I think the best case scenario is we're stuck there for a long time. You can get troop numbers down. You can get U.S. casualties down. But it's not going to be like the occupations of Korea or Japan or Germany. Because as long as U.S. troops are there, some are going to be involved in violence, some will be fighting. As long as you have counter-terror missions against Al-Qaeda, some people will be getting killed. As long as you have U.S. advisors to Iraqi troops, some will be out in fights and some will be getting killed. The fewer American troops you have on the ground, also the less situational awareness you have, the less understanding you have of the situation. One anecdote that really worried me is not long ago, a Turkmen police chief who was feuding with the Kurdish village used his influence, his wasta, with an Iraqi army general to call in an American Apache helicopter airstrike on this Kurdish village. The Americans came in, they looked and they said, we don't see the threat described, and they declined to fire. But the fewer troops, the fewer Americans you have there, the less awareness you have of that situation. And there's a danger you could wind up being used by Iraqis in their own feuds. One thing that American advisors will tell you is that there are still a lot of little Saddams in the Iraqi military. And when we're not around, they expect to revert to the old ways of doing things. A village bothers you, you shell it with artillery, or you call it an airstrike. My worry, though, is this time these are going to be people we created, people we empowered, people we armed and trained, not just in the Iraqi military, but also in the opposing Iraqi insurgency that we put on the payroll, the Sunni insurgency, who we've also helped organize. And we haven't given them arms, but we've looked the other way when they went to get arms that they knew about. So you can see now why John Stewart calls me Mr. Sunshine. I wish I had better news for you on Iraq, but I think that really is about where it's going. I'd love to get into questions and answers now. I got one request for you, actually two requests. One request is don't be too polite. I am a reporter. And the second is wait until the microphone arrives. And if you would identify yourself when you ask a question, I think it's just more interesting for everybody to know who you are. So, please, over here.
Hi. My name is Joel Mathis. I used to be a reporter in Kansas. Actually, was a reporter near Fort Leavenworth when General Petraeus and Colonel Peter Mansour was there. Got to actually interview both of them. Something that Colonel Mansour told me at the time, which I've always wondered why people don't make more of this, is he said a successful counterinsurgency generally requires at least 10 years to fight. The people who are running the war now, the counterinsurgency, seem to know that, and yet everybody in here gasped when you talked about where we're at with that. Why aren't our leaders being more honest and selling that a little bit?
It's a good question. I think there's a lot of stuff in Iraq people just don't want to hear. Ambassador Crocker would frequently talk about the Lebanization of Iraq. He talked about it in his congressional testimony. It's really striking. Here is one of America's leading diplomatic experts on the Middle East. This is a guy who has been an official representative in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq and Lebanon, in fact, was blown up inside the U.S. Embassy in Beirut when it was blown up. And he said, I see Iraq going the way of Lebanon. He specifically meant that Muqtadir al-Sadr's Mahdi army resembled Hezbollah in both being inside the Iraqi government, as Hezbollah is inside the Lebanese government, but also outside with its own independent force, its own armed militia. So the state didn't have a monopoly on the use of violence, which is one of the classic definitions of a strong state. People don't hear this stuff. I don't know why, that we're going to be there a long time. And I think also people hear in some ways what they want to hear. President Obama campaigned on getting U.S. combat troops out of Iraq in 16 months. I don't know what that phrase means. There is no such thing as non-combat troops in the U.S. military. There is no pacifist wing of the military. I think what people heard was no more U.S. troops dying after 16 months. But that's not going to happen. And frankly, I would rather be with infantry than with transport troops in Iraq. Infantry, you go on foot patrol. Nobody's going to waste a bomb on two soldiers. They like to go after trucks full of four, hitting a bunch of soldiers or hitting a bunch of trucks. So the transport troops are more vulnerable to the big bombs than our infantry. So I don't know why this hasn't sunk in. I noticed the reaction to my book. I've had a lot of this excerpted in the Washington Post over the last week. People say, why are you advocating staying in Iraq? And it's not so much advocating, just saying, look, that's the facts. We are just there. We are so stuck. And people here don't seem to recognize it. I think one reason also is Iraq isn't even our most troublesome war right now. The Pakistan-Afghanistan war is more troublesome and is more of an existential threat to this country, because if Pakistan breaks up, then you have Islamic extremists potentially holding nuclear weapons, and that's al-Qaeda's dream and our nightmare. And the sad thing is, that's not even Barack Obama's biggest problem. His number one problem, of course, is the economy. So here he has inherited the worst foreign policy situation that any president has ever inherited, and it's not even his foremost problem. That's scary. Yes, please.
Yes, my name is Lansana Kuruma from West Africa, Sierra Leone. The demonstration of the Iraqi journalists by sending the suits of President Bush, that is exactly the majority view. It's just that all the Iraqis don't have the chance to demonstrate it. Now, my question is, the press has been calling the invaders the Allied forces and calling the citizens that were invaded the terrorists, the criminals. How will you solve that problem? That's one. My second and last question is, what is happening in Iraq without any prosecution of the former leadership of the United States in any form? Do you think that the peace America is asking for in Iraq will be successful, like from President Bush? Everybody knows without no story that the invasion was wrong, was baseless. It was just because he wanted to do it. And people were involved. And thousands, if not a million lives, is being destroyed. How can you reconcile?
How can I reconcile? That was your
answer. Yeah, with the international community and the Iraqis. Yeah.
There's a bunch of good questions. I think they represent the way a lot of people feel. On Iraq, what's striking in Iraq is, yeah, I do think the shoe thrower represented a lot of Iraqi feelings. Not just anti-Americanism, but a feeling of being disrespected, a feeling of being humiliated by the Americans. And this is actually something that General Petraeus and General Odierno really tried to address, to sit down and listen to Iraqis. Not just to tell them what was going to happen, but to listen to what they thought should happen and where Iraq was at. I remember one of the honor moments in my interviews with General Petraeus. What I did was a series of interviews over the last few years. I go out to Iraq and every couple of months and interview, do hundreds of hours of interviews, actually, all of them embargoed for publication in this book. And one day, General Petraeus was talking about the Iraqi sense of dignity. And I said, well, what you really are saying is what they need is, and he said, yes, exactly. And he began singing Aretha Franklin, R-E-S-P-E-C-T. And I think they appreciated that. That's one reason they tried to talk more about Iraqi sovereignty and so on, though I think it's kind of a semi-sovereignty. It has a government that sort of sometimes acts like a sovereign nation, but it's still an occupied country with 144,000 foreign troops there. Iraq generally is in a contradictory state. Nobody in Iraq really wants us there, but very few people really want us to leave immediately. Even when you talk to Sadr's people, they talk about, well, you should leave eventually, but not right now. Because American troops, especially in the new posture they've been in the last couple of years, increasingly are the glue that is holding the situation together. If you withdrew American forces, you very easily could see the Shiite death squads going after the Sunni communities again and the Sunni insurgents going after Shiite communities again. One of the things that the Americans did in 07 was really try to protect the Sunni communities that were left in Baghdad. By the time the surge began, the ethnic cleansing of Baghdad was almost complete. There's basically a few Sunni zoos left, mainly in West Baghdad. And that's why you had to put these big walls up around them. Just really to keep the Shiite death squads out, they would create it so there was just one entrance into those neighborhoods. And that did interrupt the cycle of violence, where Sunnis would go and blow up Shiite meeting places, marketplaces, and mosques, and then Shiite death squads would respond by going into Sunni neighborhoods at night and killing people. Terrorists. Yeah, it's like the old saying is one man's guerrilla, one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist. There are people in Iraq who are flat-out terrorists. There's a lot of just people who are flat-out criminals and thugs. One of the problems there is that a lot of the middle class has fled, the doctors, lawyers, journalists, professors, who are the glue of a secular society. Disproportionately, these are the 2 million people who have left the country. What you have left in Iraq, overwhelmingly, is the men of the gun, people who believe in the use of force. On every side, people who see politics as a zero-sum game where you want to wipe out your enemy before he wipes you out. Finally, on what Americans should do about it. Overall, I would like to see a Truth and Reconciliation Commission akin to what South Africa had after the end of apartheid, but more about the use of torture than about Iraq. I think Iraq was a terrible mistake. Probably the invasion of Iraq was the biggest mistake in the history of American foreign policy, and it was also launched on false premises, as you say. But torture bothers me even more. Torture attacks the idea of America. Torture drags the American name through the mud. And I would like to see people deal with that. I'm kind of a one-issue voter on this. What I would like to see is, like they did in South Africa, an amnesty declared. People come forward, tell us what you did. And I'm not really interested in prosecution of the low-level CIA guy who pulled out fingernails in Karachi. I want to know who gave the orders, what the orders were, how they were conveyed, who thought this was the right thing to do, especially to make sure it doesn't happen again. And what you do is say, come forward by a date certain. After that, you're liable to prosecution. You've had your hand up for a while. I'm sorry.
My name's Christine Biggie. I'm a trauma nurse, and I'll play the devil's advocate here. Have there been any substantial successes from this war that likely would not have been achieved without the invasion and the occupation?
When the Bush administration says, we got rid of Saddam Hussein, honestly, I'm not sure we did in this sense. We got rid of an aging, toothless tiger who didn't have weapons of mass destruction, who really was having a hard time maintaining control of that country. What we may have eventually replaced him is a new, smarter, tougher, meaner, younger version of Saddam Hussein, likely more tied into Islamic extremism as well. So when the Bush administration people say that, they also like to say, let's wait the judgment of history. History may judge them even more harshly than they're being judged now. I think they may be in for a surprise. One thing that I think Iraq is not going to be, and I'm willing to bet money on this, at least my reputation too, I don't think Iraq is going to be a stable democracy that is an ally of the United States, and I will bet on that. Please, way back up there. I'm going to get a question from the cheap seats now, the bleachers. Yes, please.
My name is Andy Sabo. I have one question. Why did we invade Iraq?
This is a really interesting question. This was sort of the hole at the heart of my book, Fiasco, because as best as I can tell, there was never actually a formal cabinet meeting. It was just sort of, it happened. In January, the president said, well, of course, we're going to invade Iraq, as if the decision had preceded someone. It just sort of seemed to happen. Why did they make that decision? I don't know. It gets into psychology. I think it gets into the post-9/11 panic this country experienced when people could be stampeded, when people really didn't want to hear contrary arguments, when dissent was treated as unpatriotic. And, of course, it's in the middle of a vital region of the world. Oil, and I think oil did focus people on Iraq and said this is important. This is also why I think, by the way, Iraq is a more difficult problem for this country than the Vietnam War was. We could walk away from Vietnam. If you were Cambodian, it stunk because you suffered a Holocaust. And if you were a Vietnamese ally of the Americans, you might spend 15 years in the communist re-education camp. But in America, 6 years later, everybody declared it mourning in America when Ronald Reagan was elected. It ain't going to be mourning in the Middle East anytime soon. I think we're there for a long, difficult haul, and I think it's going to be harder than we understand at this point. And we can't walk away from it, partly because of oil. I mean, I think people say, did we go to war for oil? And I say, no, but I think we're stuck in it because of oil. You walk away from that, from Iraq now, you probably will see a civil war, probably a genocidal level of violence, and probably the intervention of other countries. Turkey has repeatedly intervened in the north and has said it will go to war to prevent an independent Kurdistan. Iran is already intervening in Iraq and is all over the place. And if the Shiites, feeling the Americans were no longer around to get in their way, started going after the Sunnis again and committing genocidal levels of violence. Saudi Arabia has promised it will intervene on the behalf of the Sunnis, and so I think what other Sunni Arab states like Jordan and Egypt. So it's a real recipe for further trouble. In retrospect, our foreign policy in the Middle East wasn't so bad. For 50 years after the Suez Crisis, we managed to be influential in the Middle East without having troops on the ground. Well, George Bush managed to break that. And once you put troops on the ground, man, it's hard to get them off. I'm not sure that answers your question, but that's my riff on what a messy situation it is. Yes, please.
I'm Amaris Elliott Engel. I'm a journalist at a legal newspaper. I've recently been struck by commentary listening to some radio talk shows. Callers will say, you know, they're kind of a leftist posture, a pacifist posture, saying we need to get out of Iraq, we need to get out now because this is a colonial enterprise, this is the worst thing we can be doing to continue there. I'm curious what you would say to someone who has that kind of political perspective that continuing to have a military presence is not a good idea because it's going to, you know, continue this colonial enterprise. It's just going to continue to mess up Middle East politics, you know, with the, particularly with the Israel continuing, some people say occupation, okay. Some people say not.
It's not only what would I say, it's what did I say. Yesterday I was interviewed by a Pacifica radio station on the West Coast, and the guy interviewed me said, "What do you say to people who tell you this war is immoral?" I said, "I agree. I mean, what's not to agree with here? But just because you think it's immoral doesn't mean it's moral to simply stop that war. I mean, America, I think, has a responsibility here. We walked into something. We have created a huge mess in the middle of the Middle East. Just because you walk out of a movie in the middle of the movie doesn't mean it ends. It just means you have less sense of what's happening there. I don't think we're looking for good solutions here. What we're looking for is the least bad solution. All the answers are bad. All the answers are, to some degree, immoral. I think war is a psychotic activity to begin with. The question is not, is the, you know, what's the good solution, what's the bad solution? The question is, they're all bad, so what are you going to do about it? That's where we are now. I mean, this is the fruit of the poison tree or the result of the original sin. This is actually one reason I admired a lot of people I write about in this book, like Emma Sky and Saadi Othman. These are people who thought the war was a bad thing that shouldn't have happened, or like Petraeus thought it had been poorly executed. Nonetheless, said, let me do the best I can for my country to make a bad situation somewhat better. As David Kilcullen, the Australian anthropologist, was fond of saying, just because you invade a country stupidly doesn't mean you should leave it stupidly. And so he was saying, let's try to figure out a better way to do this. Emma Sky was saying, let's try to find a way to mitigate the American presence so it doesn't end in a total bloodbath. What I've been surprised by in the last couple of days, I've been on book tour last week in New York, people saying, forget it, let's just leave. We can't afford to be there. We have our own financial crisis. Let them have a bloodbath. And that just chills me. I can understand the impulse, but I think people need to think through what that actually means. I mean, I think it's a terrible thing. Yes, please, way up there.
Why do you think that whenever we will leave Iraq, it will not be a bloodbath?
Because I think we're really stuck there, and I think it's going to be a generational situation. I don't think the outcome is going to be particularly good. As I said, nobody in Baghdad will tell you it's going to be a stable democracy that's an American ally. It's almost certainly going to be closer to Tehran as a country than it is to the U.S. government. But the hope is, and it's not a huge hope, you stick around for a while, a new generation of leadership emerges, people find certain ways of living with each other, and it winds up looking maybe, if you're lucky, like the Balkans look now. You know, the Kosovars don't like the Serbs, but nobody's killing each other in large numbers. And that's sort of the best hope. But it's not even going to be that good. Yes, please.
Yes, I'm Harris Ominsky. I'm old enough to remember what might be called three fiascos, the Korean War, Vietnam War. My question is this. What is wrong with our political and military system in the United States that gets us into these things and has us handle it so poorly?
I don't know. I suspect that might be my third book out. I'm not going to write the third part of this trilogy next because I think this is a story to be continued, the Iraq thing. But I'm going to hold off for 7 or 15 years or so before I try to write the end of this thing. So the next book I'm thinking about is looking at American history from 1940 to the present, sort of asking this. Why in World War II, for example, was there such accountability among generals? 17 division commanders were filed in World War II. A general can't get fired these days unless, as the saying goes, he's found with a dead girl or a live boy. Why have we changed in the way we think about this? Why do we go to war? I think it really is in some ways a generational thing. People forget what a mess that was. Oh, it's going to be different this time. And we get kind of hubristic and think we can go around and tell the rest of the world how to live. There is sort of this American ideal that people want to export without really thinking through it. I keep on thinking, actually, oddly enough, of something Warren Buffett said, which is when you put a great chief executive in charge of a failing company and a failing industry, it's the company's reputation that survives, not the executives. In the same way, I think we all thought, or a lot of Americans thought we were going to go change Iraq, but I think Iraq changed us in many ways more. We became more like the Middle East. Our democracy didn't work so well for several years. We were a nation looking for vengeance rather blindly and curtailing our own liberties, our own, and really eroding a lot of our own values, the idea of this country, and behaving more like a Middle Eastern country. And I think it's a really sad time in American history. I do think this is actually worse than Korea or Vietnam. Remember, the Korean War only lasted, what, about 19 months, of which only a small part of that was really extremely violent, and a lot of it was stasis on the front lines. This war is going to last longer than the Vietnam War, I'm here to tell you right now. This is going to be the longest war in American history, longer than the Revolution. I mean, we're now, what, almost 6 years into this thing, and it's going to be going a long time. This is actually one thing, when Obama talks about getting out of Iraq, this is what worries me. That's not a departure from Bush, that's a continuation of the Bush posture. It's this persistent, unwarranted optimism about Iraq that really worries me. George Bush's original, he didn't say, let's invade Iraq and stay there for 10 years. No, Bush's plan was, let's get out in a few months. The original plan was to be down to 30,000 troops by September 2003, 6 months after the invasion. Here we are, more than 5 years later, with more than four times that number of troops. Obama, I think, is going to have the same experience. He's going to find he was overly optimistic about what he could do about Iraq, and I do worry that Iraq is going to change him more than he changes Iraq. How are we doing on time? Okay. I want to do two-handers, which is the marriage preservation questions, that if you don't get to ask your question, you're going to go home muttering to your spouse all night. So who has got a two-hander? You got a two-hander. Right here. Ma'am, you're welcome.
Thank you very much. President Obama has talked a lot about the real issue is Pakistan and Afghanistan, which seems to me another sinkhole where we're dealing with highly religious conflict and furthermore drug lords and other people who have an interest in keeping the country under their control. But he says that's going to be the number one priority. How far can we go there?
It's a good question. One thing I do like about the Obama administration in their immediate first days dealing with this is they began talking about as the Pakistan-Afghanistan problem or the Afghan-Pakistan problem, which is the right way to think about it. It's not a war in one country. It's a regional war. And as a friend of mine, Andrew Exum, says, it's hard to win a war in Afghanistan when the enemy decides to fight it in Pakistan. And the more important part of that war is Pakistan. We could have a disaster in Afghanistan, and essentially we could, you know, it would be bad, but it wouldn't be desperate for us. If we have a disaster in Pakistan, that really is very worrisome. Pakistan is a large country. India is not going to stand by and watch its nuclear weapons go loose. India would be very worried to have that happening. And I don't like the idea of Islamic extremists having nuclear weapons, especially if they're small groups who are stateless entities and really undeterrable, that you can't deter them as you can deter a state. So I think it's a real problem. I don't see a lot of good answers. I think what we're going to try to do is manage the crisis, kick the can down the road, try to keep a lid on it, and hope that a new internal answer emerges, maybe with generational change. But again, you're talking about years and years. This is not going to be solved anytime soon. And it very likely is going to get worse before it gets better. I was really stunned to see that Pakistan, in the last couple of weeks, first of all, there was video in Al Jazeera of Pakistani troops and tanks retreating from the Taliban. Tanks? That tells you the Taliban in Pakistan is not just a bunch of guys running around with AK-47s, light weapons. These are guys who are scaring tanks, which means they have rocket-propelled grenades and probably mines along the roads. That's a force that looks more like Hezbollah, who took on the Israelis pretty successfully in the summer of 06, than it looks like the insurgency in Iraq. And that's really worrisome. The second thing that happened in Pakistan recently, and I think the New York Times front page this today, is that Sharia law has been declared by the Taliban in Swat, which is not one of the autonomous frontier areas that is actually part of Pakistan proper. And this rigid Islamic law has been declared with the approval of the Pakistani government, which means the Taliban is now basically setting the terms for how part of Pakistan operates about 100 miles from the capital. So Taliban influence is really growing there. So I think Pakistan is going to get worse before it gets better, and what you're going to see is Richard Holbrooke and David Petraeus working really hard simply to keep this from getting much, much worse quickly. Two-handers. These got to be two-handers where the whole way home you're going to be muttering. Okay. The right here. Next to the trauma nurse.
John Shepherd, Tom. You are in many ways the last of a breed, a full-time military reporter. In fact, since I don't think you any longer work for the Post, you are, you know, the breed is dead.
I'm alive.
What is your response to that, and what do you think the impact of the decline in the number of military reporters who really understand the business is?
It is worrisome to me, but it's part of the larger, more general decline of American journalism as the business model of newspapers falls apart, and we have an expert, Vernon Loeb, in the front, who's sitting here trying to run the Philadelphia Inquirer. I basically got out of the newspaper industry, as you say. I now hang my hat on the think tank, and I'm a full-time book writer. I really do worry about how, I mean, it's not like newspaper, there's no other way to have a democracy without newspapers, but that's the way this democracy has operated for a couple hundred years. I'm not just worried about military reporters, so that's something that's near and dear to me, because I think it's one of the most serious things a country can do is kill other people and for its purposes. But I'm worried about city council meetings. As newspapers cut back, as newspapers fold, by the end of this year, you're going to see major American cities without a daily newspaper. And the city councils, they're going to just go to town. You know, it's going to be Christmas time, you know, for all the aldermen of Chicago and Detroit and so on. Because nobody's going to be at those meetings. Nobody pays the blogger to go to the meeting. I mean, this is classically the way the young reporter made his or her name. Go out and cover the, you know, rural county school board meetings when nobody else was there and sit through until 1 in the morning, which is when they used to slip in those little deals, you know. You know, when the mayor's brother got the big construction project, or so-and-so got the snowplow contract, or the school bus, the amount spent on school bus drivers doubled, you know, without any attention. We'll figure out other ways of doing that. But the country will be different without newspapers looking in nooks and crannies, asking embarrassing questions of powerful people. It's an important thing to do. And I'm not quite sure how it's going to be done. One more question? Okay. We got a, she's a waiver, so we got a. When I was a teacher, all my best students sat in the back row, all the fun kids. You know?
My name's Kristen Russo, and I'm a former Philadelphia public school teacher.
Well, thank you for your service also.
Well, thank you.
And by the way, my Aunt Margie is here. Where are you, Aunt Margie? There she is, another former teacher.
Bravo, bravo, bravo. Well, I didn't hear anything about weapons of mass destruction and the CIA feeding that information to the administration at the time, or anything about the murders that occurred, mass murders and mass graves in Iraq before we went there. But I'm not interested in any of what you have to say, but I would really like to hear what somebody who served in the war, what his question is. That's what I would like to hear. So, the gentleman who served, who is a former serviceman, mm-hmm. I'd like to hear what his question is, because he was there.
Okay, I don't want to put you on the spot, but if you have a question, I'm happy to answer. I'll use the microphone so people can hear you.
How's that?
Sounds good.
I did my tour in Iraq, 0405. I served in the U.S. Embassy as an Army colonel. I left there in 05, so I was part of the fiasco that you're talking about. But I really wasn't.
Actually, 06 was even worse.
But when I left there, it was my conclusion that there was no quick fix, political gimmick, accelerated strategy. It was dig in for the long term and prevail. And as you discussed, we're still trying to prevail. So that's more of a comment than a question. Second, when you're on the ground, as I was, it's more violent than it is watching TV or reading newspapers. It's very violent, and you're fighting evil. So I'll try to ask a question. Integrated arrangement, or fruits arrangement, Iraq, which way do you think Kirkuk province will go? Because of secretary and ethnic divide.
Which way do you think Kirkuk would go?
Right, either Greater Kurdistan or with the Baghdad government.
I have no idea. Which way? The question is, which way does Kirkuk go? Kirkuk is the disputed city. The Kurds say it's their Jerusalem. Saddam pushed a lot of Arabs up into there. They're now being pushed out by the Kurds. I don't know. My answer is the Kurds have really overplayed their hand in Iraq. They kind of got away with murder for the last several years because the Americans were so focused on Shiite Sunni tensions. And the Kurds have kind of crept down. They keep on pushing the green line south and west, the green line being their semi-official border. I remember flying over Diyala province in a helicopter back in the spring of 04. And the officer I was with said, "See all those tents down there?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Those are Arab refugees pushed out of Kirkuk, 50,000 of them down there." So there's a lot of internally displaced people, especially displaced by the Kurds. And you're right to ask this question because Kurdish-Arab tensions are increasing right now, and that has never really been resolved. The Peshmerga, the Kurdish army, still forms the backbone of the Iraqi army. It's the most reliable forces. And if the United States ever pushes the Kurds hard, the Kurdish response is likely to be pulling the Peshmerga units out of Baghdad, which would increase the destabilization of Baghdad very quickly. So I don't know. But it's just it's one more on sort of the list of top 100 worries about Iraq. You're right about violence, though. I think people back here, and this is where I began by talking, people back here don't understand quite how violent Iraq was, especially in the spring of 07. 06 was horrible. It was like a civil war going on in the streets of Baghdad. But spring of 07, American troops had to fight their way from these big bases out into the neighborhoods where they're going to be based. And I'll actually end by talking about one unit was telling me about going out there. Another unit actually told me they hit 50 bombs simply moving to their outpost because the enemy knew where they were going to move into. It was pretty clear what the most important building to have in this neighborhood was. This other unit was going out, and they got involved in a firefight with local insurgents trying to keep them from coming into the neighborhood. In the middle of the firefight, the platoon sergeant looked up and saw two Iraqi kids, terrified, paralyzed with fear, standing in the middle of the street. And he jumped up, talked to one kid under each arm, and rolled over to a corner. And another soldier said later, that's when we won that firefight. It didn't matter what we did to the enemy. It mattered that we showed the Iraqis we were serious about protecting them. They saw an American soldier risk his life to help these two kids to protect them. That's when the Iraqis could start believing us, because they'd heard years of promises that we hadn't been able to keep. This was no more promises. This was an action. We were moving into the neighborhood. And that really was effective. But, as you say, it's a recipe for a very long haul. Thank you very much. Where will I be signing books? Upstairs? I'll sign them.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.